Hello, you're listening to They Came From the North, your weekly dose of Canadian skullduggery, tomfoolery, and shenanigans. We've got our usual remnants of Canuckistan joining me this evening. From the East Coast, I've got Mr. John Mercer.
Skullduggery is a great word.
It's not used nearly enough in this day and age.
No, it's not.
Especially with all the digging of skulls we do.
From Central Canada.
That'd be a great name for a metal band.
I'm not sure I can say that word right. Skullduggery? Huh.
From Central Canada, we've got Mr. Gabriel Girard representing the Francophone population.
Bonjour.
And representing the English speakers of Ontario, we've got Mr. Andrew Forbes.
Bonjour.
How dare you?
I'm sorry.
How dare you undermine my intro?
I got distracted by all the skullduggery and tomfoolery and shenanigans.
We've had a little bit of a controversy. We've had some negative criticisms claiming that we are biased. How dare you to our neighbors to the south?
What?
We love our neighbors to the south. And just to prove it, we've brought in...
Pants.
We've brought in token American. Say hello to Matt Avrak. Am I saying your last name properly?
That's right. I'm not Canadian, but I'm willing to learn.
Nobody's perfect.
You didn't say please.
Please.
You were nowhere near polite enough.
Please let me be Canadian.
Now go hold the door open at the mall for the first 20 people behind you.
Aw.
Then order a double-double and a BCD from Tim Hortons.
Is that a bowel movement?
No, it's not. You don't know what a BCD is?
I'm not sure that is.
What the hell is wrong with you?
Not
you, Matt. Andrew, I'm talking about.
Okay.
Austin Cream Donut.
Mm.
It's proper Canadian slang.
Not everything has to be an acronym.
It's in pop songs and everything. Come on now.
All right.
By Canadian artists, of course.
I just call it a Bocredo.
That sounds like a Mortal Kombat character.
Bocredo, Credo wins. Flawless victory.
Tonight we will be tackling, as we usually do, the bodies of work of a chosen director. Tonight we're going to go with 80s mainstay, John Hughes, who got his start writing for National Lampoon magazine before, I believe it was Vacation was his first real published film, like first written screenplay that got made. But after that, he went on to kind of start off relatively small scale with 16.
Actually, wait, I'm gonna stop and correct you there.
Yep.
Because God damn it, Mr. Mom is a diamond in the rough.
Listen.
And Class Reunion before that, but I know nothing about Class Reunion.
Exactly.
Michael Keaton is a comedic genius.
He hit with Vacation. How's that? Is that better?
That's pretty good.
Writing the screenplay for Vacation. Made his directorial debut with Molly Ringwald's debut film, 16 Candles. He would go on to make a name for himself in the 80s, directing what many refer to as the new Brat Pack films. He had, you know, The Breakfast Club. He had Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Some Kind of Wonderful. No, he wrote Some Kind of Wonderful, sorry. He had She's Having a Baby. In between there, he did pump out Planes, Trains, and Automobiles after kind of being afraid he'd be pigeonholed into 80s teen films. He did have Uncle Buck, which was a John Candy vehicle. And probably the biggest success of his career when he wrote and produced Home Alone, which was, of course, a star-making turn for Macaulay Culkin.
All those many films we remember him for now.
So fondly.
Were you snapping away a tear, or was that the last of the cocaine?
What?
Turkey Monster was pretty good, actually.
I was about to mention Party Monster. His final directorial film would be Curly Sue, which was a 90s Jim Belushi family comedy vehicle. Tragically, he would lose his life, surprisingly, in 2009, while on a walk in New York visiting family. He did succumb to a heart attack, so our sympathies to Mr. Hughes. We'll get right down to it. We're going to start with Matt, because he's our newcomer. Matt, what would you choose as your good for director John Hughes?
All right, I'm going to have to go with Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Woo!
It's just one that I think John Hughes' strength, I mean, objectively, he's probably not a great filmmaker, but he had a real knack for connecting with young people. And when I was that age, when I was in high school, Ferris Bueller had been out for a while, but I never really saw it till I was in high school, and that's when it really clicked with me. It's like, you know, I don't think kids are going to be watching, you know, your Criterions or any of that. Kids are going to be watching movies made for them on their level, and that's when they're really clicked. I think it just spoke to me the way that, you know, it was meant to, and had some cartoonish characters, but they were ridiculous in a good way and a total line of absurdity. And I just thought, you know, that's his best movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, for me, I mean, Ferris Bueller, to me, it's the only movie where he really manages to nail the sort of slight unreality of the world he's doing. Mm-hmm. A lot of his movies, I find, you know, he tries to have, you know, he tries to mix comedy with then these very sincere, dramatic moments, and sometimes the comedy is just sort of too outlandish and it doesn't mix well, or, you know, he tries to go a little fantastical, especially, say, with Weird Science, and it just comes off as awkward. But with Ferris Bueller, he really sort of nailed that fine line between, genuinely evoking that sort of feeling of being a teen toward the end of high school, and that larger-than-life kind of goofy comedy as well, especially with the Jeffrey Jones principal.
he was almost, you know, the only really overtly humorous part of that movie, I found.
Really?
Yeah, I found Ferris Bueller was kind of more...
Well, I think he was the only character that was created to maybe solely to be a punchline, in a sense.
To be a comedic role. Everything else felt more, you know,
He was the heel. But, I mean, there's very little in John Hughes' filmography that I find funnier than Jeffrey Jones running and then stopping and walking by a classroom door and then running and then stopping and walking. Like, that's just so perfect. Like, it so perfectly just comments on how absurd high school can be.
I love the little interactions with his secretary.
Mm-hmm.
Grace!
You sounded just like Dirty Harry then.
One thing that always surprised me was the breaking of the fourth wall stuff in that movie. I think that's kind of uncommon for 80s comedies. Like the fact that he talks right to the camera and then the post-credit stuff.
He sort of went in that direction a few times, but I don't think he ever did it overtly. But I think there are a number of points where he's got a character sort of look at the camera and then look away. I remember at least one in Weird Science. But yeah, I mean, sort of framing it that way, I think, is partially what made the more like absurd parts of it work a bit better, because it was sort of acknowledging, yes, this is a movie. So I like it.
And it's a good way to introduce art to young people too.
I like about Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and I mean, it says a lot for the movie itself, for the quality of the film, and I think a lot of it has to do with Broderick as well, that the movie really has kind of taken on a life of its own in the years since it came out. And I mean, he's got his cult following, you know, he's got his fans. The Breakfast Club has a legion of fans, 16 Candles has a legion of fans, you know, but there's something about Ferris Bueller's Day Off, like you have people, you know, starting to theorize now that, oh, maybe Ferris wasn't even a real person. Maybe it was all, what was the other guy?
Cameron.
Yeah,
Cameron.
It's all in Cameron's head, and Ferris Bueller was kind of his ego or his id or something talking to him and stuff. And like a lot of that, like, you really see a lot of that kind of analysis with Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and it, from what started as a pretty simple movie, and I mean, you know, when you look at Hughes' body of work, you look at stuff like Curly Sue or Beethoven or Home Alone, And I think it really was just as simple as, you know, a guy wanting to ditch school for a day. But it really has kind of snowballed and it has taken on this life of its own, you know?
But, I mean, I think it was a good frame. Like, it was a good way to sort of set up a story about these kids who are they're in their last year of high school. They're sort of just on the verge of adulthood and sort of wanting to step out on their own and sort of fulfill their own personality, I guess. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with Nathan Rabin of the Onion AV Club coined the term Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
About all these movies with, you know, this uptight guy, and then he meets this like whimsical girl who flits around and, you know, makes him learn to connect with his inner self. Ferris Bueller might be the first one, except it's Matthew Broderick. He's the Manic Pixie Dream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Cameron is the uptight boy who, you know, has to be brought out of his shell, I suppose. Man, Alan Ruck was 29. And he might be the most convincing high school kid in any of John Hughes' movies.
Yeah, seriously.
I really feel bad for Cameron at the end of it, because you know his dad's going to beat the shit out of him.
In all realism, yeah.
What's yeah, like, he doesn't see
you never even really see his dad in the movie, and all I can picture is like just this guy not saying a word, just shaking his head with his lip pursed in anger, and then taking
you know,
his belt
John,
off.
Not all of us have dads who tucked us into bed while holding a tire iron.
That's only because of the wolves. He was protecting me from the wolves. Okay, I was his boy. His only boy.
He had to make sure you'd be a good boy.
He had to make sure you were tender and juicy.
I pay the iron price.
Oh, come on.
I think it says something, though, about the father character that we never meet him, but we feel like he's another character, too.
He's a presence, yeah.
Yeah. Kind of like
saying,
an actor Ravenwood.
You know, saying that Cameron was going to get the shit beat out of him. The fact that you don't see Cameron's parents, I think it's kind of important because I think it's John Hughes' way of saying, you know, all of the anxieties that Cameron feels about his dad, it is entirely about how he perceives what his dad is going to do and how he's going to react. And sort of once he gets over that anxiety, like once he's pushed to the point where it's like, oh, well, shit, I'm going to have to talk my way out of this now because the car's in the ditch, right?
Yeah, I just drove the car out into the back here.
He completely calms down, right? Like, it becomes a it's just another problem that he just, you know, has to deal with. So that's one of the things about the movie. I think it really nails that sort of sense of how, you know, how teens view their problems and how they seem so insurmountable, right? And then, I mean, really, it's just like, okay, yeah, your dad's cold and stuff, but you have to talk to him. So,
Andrew, what happens when you got to pay bills?
What's that?
You think that's a problem? Imagine paying bills.
Exactly. So, as opposed to some of his other movies about teens, I actually think that as over the top as it is, Ferris Bueller has some of the more realistic portrayal of, you know, high school kids and how they feel about the world.
My only big problem with Ferris Bueller, and it's kind of, like, call bullshit on me for calling it out if you want to, but I hate the museum scene. I despise that scene. It is so atypical of those characters' behavior for the rest of the film. It just feels like this is the scene where you was kind of lost it and just started to kind of wank a little bit, you know? Mm. Got a little bit self-indulgent, I think.
But it's what, like a minute and a half?
It's a little more than that, and it's a pretty profound scene in the movie. It's kind of like this, almost like an awakening scene, you know? But, like, you've got Ferris Bueller there basically being a snobby art critic and stuff, and it's just, you know, I'm sorry, that's the one point in the movie for me where it's like, no, these guys don't act like that, you know?
No, I thought they were just, you know, goofing off, and then, I mean, it's obviously, it's not a subtle way of doing it, but, you know, it's... I don't think it's out of character. I mean,
I find it is. I just... To me, it felt false. To me, it just didn't ring true at all. It makes
they
it
wouldn't,
crazy.
They would go and goof off in a museum?
But they weren't goofing off. They were standing there, like, oogling paintings. Like they were
adopting the like most stereotypical art snob pose. It was not that they were actually appreciating the art, Steve. They were
at one point the mutant comes in and Cameron really has this awakening.
Cameron does that one thing with the picture while Ferris and Sloan are making out. Like that's just him on his own. But everything else about that, they're like just like gooping off. It's completely in character, and Cameron's just like bored and zoning off.
I to me it seemed like it was played differently.
That's I call bullshit, sir.
Go ahead.
I will.
But that's just how I felt about it. It didn't ring true with me at all. And it was something about the way it was shot and the way it was presented that it just rubbed me the wrong way.
Well, I mean, it was sort of like a stylistic change. They came in with that, I guess it's kind of like dreamier music and like, I don't know.
It became an art film.
Did you just call a John Hughes movie an art film?
He tried. Lord knows he tried.
Ooh.
Who's next?
He tried more than that.
Who's next? Anyone? Anyone?
I'll go.
Bueller?
Because I also chose Bueller. and yeah, I mean, I pretty much said what I'm going to say. I talked over everyone else, so. We can move on to the next person's good.
How about you, Gabriel?
My good has to be Plane, Swains, and Automobiles. It really feels like it's only really grown up picture, and I think these characters they're very interesting, and I don't know, there's just something about that movie that connects more to me than the rest of his stuff, which I'm kind of blah about.
Would you say it's that you just don't identify with the teen characters?
Well, mostly I find them to all. I feel that they're all pretty much, except for Bueller. I have to get that to Bueller, but the rest of his stuff, they're all one-dimensional, pretty much. You know, you've got this one characteristic that defines you, and although he tries to break down that stuff in The Breakfast Club, I don't think it really works.
He pretty much just reinforces it in The Breakfast Club.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is probably my second favorite of his movies, and the only reason it doesn't sort of rank as high as Bueller for me is I really find the way he deals with that last sort of dramatic reveal, I think he does it awfully, and he completely overplays the pathos of it. His wife is like dripping snot and tears because her husband has been on a business trip for 2 days, and she like runs out and she's like, "Oh my God, you're home!"
I have to agree with that. Like I was too. Up at the end, and I was hating myself for it because I knew I was being manipulated.
I think it's totally reasonable go ahead, Gabe.
But I think it's mostly to feel that it's because I felt that their friendship, you know, the connection between these two men that has been established, that's what was getting more to me, like at the end of the picture, that he's ready to bring him to his family and introduce him as a friend. Mm-hmm.
I never felt like they could actually maintain a friendship. I felt like all the times they bonded, it was in these extreme situations, and you know, unless one or both of them had a complete personality shift, they couldn't actually continue a friendship in the real world or even in the movies world. Like I didn't buy it. And for most of the movie, I really liked the dynamic between the two. Like, they had a great chemistry, and I believed it when they started to sort of come together towards the end. But I'm just really not sold, you know?
It was really sudden. Think,
yeah, and the funny thing is that basically only Martin kind of grows, and Candy never changes. He just stays the same cigar-smoking lout.
Exactly.
I think it's Martin's movie, though. You know,
it is Martin's movie, and that's. Yeah. I also picked Planes, Trains as my good because I have loved it ever since I was a kid. And to me, now I could be wrong on this, but it's the first time I can remember Martin really settling into that straight man role in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Steve Martin was more like his stand-up comedy at this point, he was the wry observer.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was really, when you look back at it, it was a star-making turn for John Candy. You know, it was any like the anger management issue stuff that you got in his earlier roles. He really, as Gabriel put it, you know, he transformed into a lovable lout.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it really is Martin's story, and it's his character's. I think it's Neil is his name.
Yeah.
It's Neil's journey, right? He's the one that has to change.
Yeah,
but that's still funny too. That the annoyance of John Candy is like presented as the good thing in this movie. You know, because I mean, I would have that guy. I am a pretty tolerant person, but to have that guy like.
Wafting his foot odor onto you on a seat next door.
His dogs were barking. What do you want? Let's just say, guys, the scene on the freeway, driving on the wrong side of the road, is one of the absolute funniest scenes in movie history.
Ah, you're drunk.
Fuck the AFI. And then there's all, just so many brilliant, funny, hilarious moments in it. The taxiola.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm not going to argue that. I mean, I find it's a hilarious movie, and most of it I absolutely love. I mean, them, you know, being pulled over in that burnt-out husk of a car by Michael McKean, and you know, anything. Do you think this is a roadworthy vehicle? And he's like, yes, I do. I really believe that, sir. Like, them kind of trying to talk their way out of that. Like, that's... It's full of stuff like that, and I love it. It's just I feel like Hughes didn't really tie together the dramatic strings at the end.
Now Hughes was also has also been known for shooting miles upon miles upon miles of film. Right, mm-hmm. the guy was a terrible, terrible editor. And like I really have to agree with you guys. I do think the end of it was a little bit ham-fisted. It kind of comes out of nowhere. You know, there's. At no point for me was there any real reason that Steve Martin needed to have that epiphany about when he goes back and finds John Candy waiting at the bus station.
Yeah.
Right? There was no reason for him to have that epiphany other than to, you know, shoehorn in every time you walk away and give us the super happy ending.
Yeah.
And I'm glad it had a super happy ending, but I just wonder, buried somewhere... in a vault, is there the scene that would explain that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Doesn't he kind of tie things together, though? You know, aren't there, like, events earlier?
You know, you kind of see, like, a couple short flashbacks of things that John Candy said.
Oh, in the, like, most sugary, sweet synth music you've ever heard.
Well, yeah.
As Steve Martin gives, you know, like a knowing sort of little chuckle. Oh, those were crazy times.
Oh, wait.
You know what?
There's a plain and simple truth that when you travel with people,
but it's
you get attached to them.
And, guys, I'm not... Don't get me wrong. Like, I absolutely adore Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and it deserves a high-ranking spot in the upper echelon of 80s comedies.
Mm-hmm. Now, if only they released a Blu-ray that wasn't slathered in DNR.
I had a difficult time, actually, because I do really like the Brat Pack flicks. I do really... Like, I love 16 Candles. I find it so absurd and hilarious. And
date rape.
Where is my car?
You're just wrong, Steve.
No, I enjoy it. I really enjoy that movie. I love The Breakfast Club. I think it's a great flick. I do, and I also absolutely love Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And that one is ultimately what I settled on. Actually, I love Ferris Bueller as well, but I did ultimately settle on Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, just because of just the candor between Candy and Steve Martin in that movie, believable or not, I found them just, they play off each other so well. And
the two of them should have done more movies together.
They really should have. And
I mean, I like Steve Martin vastly more in a straight man.
Yeah.
Steve Martin is the ultimate straight man.
Yeah.
And he should have played that role so many more times.
And the whole thing with...
The Jerk is still one of the funniest movies I've ever seen, though.
You're a jerk. Sorry.
No, it's one of those things, and one thing that I'll give you is, like, I mean, he had kind of pretty much faded into obscurity and obscurity until The Cult of Kevin Smith kind of resurrected him a little bit. And one thing I'll give you is, and I know he was an influence on Smith and some of the Smith copycats and all of that kind of stuff, but Hughes really had a gift for dialogue, for exchange. And, I mean, all of his movies, all of his characters, his movies are just so intimately quotable, and he doesn't, it never felt, like, I sit down and watch a Kevin Smith movie, like, I always said it about Chasing Amy, I always said, you know, and, I mean, people love Chasing Amy, I don't want to take it away from them, but to me, the movie always felt like an excuse to tell one joke, you know,
And the main difference, I feel, is that used dialogues, for most part, never really feels written, while you can tell that you have a writer behind the Kevin Smith movies. You know,
exactly.
It doesn't feel necessarily organic.
The other thing, too, guys, let's think about this. Hughes directed 8 movies. He wrote almost 50.
Yeah, yeah.
44 movies.
Yeah.
And I'm just looking at the list right now. And there's a couple powerhouses here, like in comedy movies, right? He wrote the first 3 Vacation movies, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. 2 of which were absolutely amazing.
Yep.
I'm not going to hold Beethoven against him.
Or The Great Outdoors.
Don't even start out Great Outdoors.
But even with me, getting back to Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, even the final scene to me works because, well, I mean, I fill up every time I see it. I can't help it. I'm a softie. But to me, it adds just a little bit of something memorable to it. You know, like that little that little twist at the end, that little realization. It elevates the movie beyond, you know, The Great Outdoors or Uncle Buck or one of these other, you know? It does.
I think it's a good thing for the characters to go through.
Yeah.
You know, it's just handled with big old hands on the fists.
Well, you know, it's...
But it's Thanksgiving. What else do you want but ham?
Exactly. And I mean, it's not meant to be an art film. I mean, he wasn't gunning for Best Picture at the Oscars with that movie. Let's face it, right? But
it's like it needed a resolution, but it was it needed something to a way to tie that together and have them end up together as friends in the end. It was a little forced. It was very forced.
Yeah,
but it needed a little more in between to make it really sell that. But it was good.
What does he sell the shower rings as?
Earrings.
Earrings.
Earrings. That scene's awesome, too.
And
I've got a Casio.
Oh, and the scene with Steve Martin and the woman who played Grace in Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, yes.
When he goes on, I think, a 2-minute straight rant with more F-bombs than Quentin Tarantino can even dream of.
The scene?
I think it's a great movie. I think it works really, really well. And it's one of those ones, you know, every year I kind of break it out, usually around, like, Christmas time, and I'll break it out and give it a watch. I really enjoy it. It's something that I always kind of stuck with.
My God. Hughes were made in Manhattan.
As crazy as the hijinks get, I can't help but feel that it's his most realistic picture. You know, just the way the characters feel, they feel very rounded and real.
Sure. I mean,
even though the stuff that's around them is completely ridiculous.
I'd say it's definitely his most, like, realistically human sort of characters.
No one's ever in a parade.
No. But everybody loves a parade.
Oh, God, it's just, it's, It's such a beautiful, simple story, you know? Trying to get home for the holidays.
Yeah.
Oh, we've all been there.
Now we move on to the bad, which is our...
Dead silence.
Which is not exactly our... Like, it's not a bad film. It's just a flawed movie that we may or may not enjoy, or something that we would enjoy only for certain elements that just kind of, you know, rub us the wrong way. I'll start again with Matt.
All right, my choice for bad is 16 Candles.
My God.
I think the first hour is pretty good, but I think it completely falls apart in that last half hour. I think it focuses too much on the wedding with a sister that we've barely seen, and I just wish it would focus more on the kids. And they're not the best defined, but again, he handles conversations really well, little character moments, and he almost has an ensemble thing going with some zany comedy. You do start to connect with some of these characters, but by the end, it's kind of wishy-washy, and it just kind of goes all over the place. And that
also,
last half hour.
Racism and rape.
Yeah.
Man, I gotta 1984.
Say, not like this, Jake. Not like this.
As bad as Long Duck Dong is, I had laughed my ass off whenever he was on the screen.
Mullied!
Yeah, I mean, it's not, it's so stupid, it's so silly, but I can't
he
help smile.
I respectfully disagree.
If I wanted to, I could violate her 10 ways to Sunday or something. They actually says that line. Ooh. But I'll...
And hey, you can take my passed out girlfriend home, wink wink. Because actually, I don't really like her anymore. Wink wink. Oh, what? We had non-consensual sex? Oh, I love you now. Gong. Banzai!
Don't you forget about me.
Oh, Lord. I also picked 16 Candles as my bad, which is why I let out an oh my god when Matt said that, because apparently we're just running along the exact same track here. I find a lot of 16 Candles pretty good. I don't think that Molly Ringwald is a very good actress, but I think, especially as, you know, being inexperienced and young, you know, I think she does a pretty good job. And she gets that sort of like insecure high school kid thing going. But I have some pretty serious problems with it too, which I've just alluded to. I don't know if you can guess what they are. But also, I mean, there's some pretty just like cartoonish nonsense in this movie.
It's just
that
ridiculous,
feels,
man.
I mean, like there's a play, like, it's not like I don't mind, like, I hate movies that have ridiculousness in them. I know this is a comedy, but I mean, there are some things in this that are just too ridiculous for me. The idea that she wouldn't have just like hauled off and punched Anthony Michael Hall in the mouth by about the eighth time he literally climbed on top of her. Like, there were some things that really irritated me, but.
And then she just gives him her panties for no reason.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, you know, I'll give you my underwear. And then forgets that she'd get it back or something. And, you know, the way it treats...
So we could get a stack of floppy disks.
And there you go. That's leading right into my next thought. I mean, the way that John Hughes portrays quote-unquote nerds in his movies infuriates me. Like, this movie, she actually gets on the bus and two guys turn around with, like, sci-fi headgear and, like, laser guns. And they're like, meh, direct hit. It's just like, no, that does not exist in any world. Like... It's like there are characters from a real high school world, and then there are characters from the most stereotyped high school you could ever imagine, and they're trying to come together, and it just doesn't mesh.
It was also his first directorial debut, so...
Mm-hmm.
That's
true.
His second directorial debut.
And like I said, I mean, there's a lot to like in the movie. It's just, it feels like for every, you know, every step forward, then there's a misstep. So, that's where I'm at with it.
Then again, there is the site of... Of Long dancing with Lumberjack.
See, I love this movie. There's just so much about it that makes me laugh hysterically. The grandmother, like, at the church, when they get to the church, and the scene before that where the bride is freaking out because she's got her period on her wedding day, and I'm just, this movie is absolutely ridiculous. But I'm laughing hysterically.
Oh, but the other thing I meant to mention, Molly Ringwald's little brother, he's just like that John Hughes template asshole kid that I hate, and I don't find it funny. It's just like, oh, this kid is a total asshole. Nice.
Wait a second. Was Jake the Indian kid from Vision Quest?
Does anyone else actually remember Vision Quest but me?
Can you hang on while I do a whole bunch of Googling?
Yeah, I do. I gotta say, I love 16 Candles. I just find it totally ridiculous. And I guess, you know, my sensibilities aren't really offended by it because of just how ridiculous it is.
It could be worse. It could be Pretty in Pink.
I actually own Pretty in Pink.
Character actor.
I think Doc would have been completely justified in stabbing Molly Ringwald at the end of that movie. Stabbing her and leaving her in a gutter. Andrew Clay saying, "Hey, what are we going to do now? Hey, we got to hide the body in a dumpster."
Ugh.
He was in Fish with Best.
Yeah. At first I thought that was Matt Dillon, too. It was just like...
I kept thinking of Matt Dillon.
Andrew, you already picked your bad, so John, I just, one of you got your bad. I'm mixing things up.
Me?
Yeah.
My bad. Just a second.
Ferris Bueller.
Uncle Buck.
Oh.
Uncle Buck.
Uncle Buck. Uncle Buck has exactly one thing going for it.
John Candy.
John Candy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I would put Macaulay Culkin in the going for it pile as well.
Really?
He's awesome in this movie.
Yeah, the two little kids don't infuriate me.
Who are you?
He was like six. Cut him some slack. And John Candy is like 8 feet tall. He's like my Uncle Ron. He's like the most terrifying person in the world when you're that little.
The scene where he's trying to talk, the kids out of wanting to sleep with him, I'm just like, why didn't you tell them that you were going to roll over and crush them to death? Because that is what would happen.
It's like, dude, you're the size of Andre the Giant.
My thing with Uncle Buck, I'm not a big fan of Uncle Buck. I don't think I'm even enough of a fan to call it my bad. But it always just felt like John Candy riffing for 90 minutes.
Yeah, and that's the thing I've got. It's like a bad Eddie Murphy movie.
Yeah.
Right? It's all you have is just this overwhelming persona. And it's somebody, you know, the entire idea for the movie was John Hughes drunk at a bar and scribbling down John Candy with kids. I blame this fucking movie for Camp Candy.
You know, actually, the thing
every time the teenage daughter crosses her arms and looks at him with her like pouty stare, I keep hoping he's gonna like just take one of his golf clubs and knock her fucking head off.
But that's the thing with the movie. She is one of the most detestable characters I've ever seen in a movie. But in being that, she's the most like actual teenagers. Like there are so many teenagers I have known who are exactly that difficult and are just like, they just hate you for everything for no reason, for no other reason than the fact that their hormones are going crazy and they just want to hate everything. And like, it's
that being said, yeah, I love the scene with her and Buck in the car when he's trying to talk her out of her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That part there is just absolute pure magic. Right. Mm-hmm. From the, you ever hear of a ritual murder?
I love that.
I love this.
Her face like that again. What
was that, Gabe?
I love when John Candy goes to the elementary school and tries to use the little tiny urinals and then like just completely rants at the principal. Like he goes berserk on her grass. I love that part.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's just
an opinion.
Yeah, just all the movie is just it's John Candy mugging at a camera for 90 or so minutes. And my wife loves it and watches it endlessly, like an 8-year-old little girl watching Mrs. Doubtfire. And I want to peel my face off every time she turns it on. And even though it's got the other girl, the one that wasn't Diane Lane from Streets of Fire.
Oh, Diane Lane in Streets of Fire.
I know, she was so beautiful.
Why did you have to bring that up?
Streets of Fire, dude. We haven't brought up Michael Wincott yet, and I'm disappointed.
He hasn't been in a John Hughes movie.
He should have.
I tried to bring up John Capellos. He's been in 3.
No Kim Coates reference yet either.
No. Kim Coates.
I guess Kim Coates kind of looks like John Capello. A bit. Imagine Kim Coates telling you he digs through your garbage. Imagine Michael Wincott telling you he digs through your garbage.
I dig through your garbage.
Imagine Michael Wincott.
He'd be safe with a broken beer bottle pointed at your chest, too.
Imagine Michael Wincott as Pooter the Clown.
John Candy wouldn't punch Michael Wincott. As soon as he turned around, he'd be stabbed.
Never touch the stuff.
Speaking of imagining Michael Wincott,
imagine Michael Wincott in the John Candy role of Uncle Ben.
you just took it right out of me, man. You just stole it from me.
That's what I was saying.
Why are you giving me such a hard time?
let's recast.
When I was your age, I was the one looking at all the pretty girls.
Let's recast every major, like, lead character in the John Hughes movie as Michael Wincott.
Oh, Molly, dude, imagine Michael Wincott is Clark Griswold.
You forgot my birthday, Mom.
Oh, God. Does Barry Manilow know you raid his wardrobe?
Oh, man.
We just keep this going and just... I think we should probably reconceptualize our podcast.
The Michael Wincott podcast.
The Michael Wincott graphic.
Where were we? Gabriel, what's your bad?
It's The Breakfast Club.
Michael Wincott as Principal Vernon.
Yeah, but see, you wouldn't get any of the wonderful moments with Joe Nunn because you'd just be too terrified to speak.
You know that kinds of fat people, those that were born fat, and those that were born skinny and became fat. Sorry.
I've got you for 2 months, and I'm going to sodomize you for all of them.
Anyway, Gabe, Breakfast Club.
This is the new school.
This is getting creepy weird.
I think The Breakfast Club is a movie that can only work when you're a teen, and then when you watch it, you realize how stagey and stupid it actually is. I mean,
well, you don't like being slapped in the face with the David Bowie quote at the beginning? What a wake-up call. It's like, this is what it feels like to be a teenager.
It's like adults don't even understand us.
Bam! Right in the face.
Oh.
And like,
sledgehammers
goth
to the
girls, if you're a goth girl, you just take off, like, your hair from your face and suddenly you turn beautiful.
Man, I always paint with dandruff. Always.
Yeah. But also, at the end, they all leave, and the nerd is left writing their homework.
At least he's not wearing sci-fi headgear.
Fair enough.
Like, imagine a Breakfast Club if Anthony Michael Hall was wearing the Johnny Depp getup from Sleepy Hollow, the headset and the goggles, for the entire movie.
I'm pretty sure you just gave Johnny Depp his idea for the next movie to remake.
He's going to play... Oh, when I thought this character, I thought of Anthony Michael Hall. But yeah, I mean, I think it's still an enjoyable movie. I just think, like, the whole philosophy and the message it's trying to pass, it doesn't earn it in any way.
Mm-hmm. I find the characters really unbelievable in every way. I find that he tries to subvert the stereotypes. He ends up basically reinforcing them. That is when he gets anything right. And most of the time, it's just like these absurd cartoonish sort of archetypes instead of people. They're just like honestly, Bender is the worst depiction of, what is he supposed to be? A bully? A tough guy?
A delinquent.
He's a metalhead. Come on.
Yeah.
He's far too smart and likable to be the criminal deviant that he's painted as in this.
What are you talking about, man? All the criminal deviants in my high school were brilliant warrior punks.
Has anyone heard the fan theory on The Breakfast Club that Bender just manipulates a different group of kids every Saturday?
No, I haven't.
I like that idea.
Oh, dude, that'd be a great show on like Showtime or HBO. It'd be like Dexter in high school.
Everybody, all the kids leave after having this big reawakening, and him and Vernon high-five each other.
The opening theme of the TV show would be like a Beck cover of We Are Not Alone.
He just drains another Molly Ringwald and throws her away until she's like a meth addict.
And all that stuff about the principal like being in the duck, that doesn't make any sense either.
No, the principal's another victim of John Bender. Because he's like the ultimate hanger-on. You know, he feels empowered when Bender's around. He's like a little dog from Looney Tunes. Dancing around the bulldog as it walks down the street. That's all he has in his life anymore.
I wish my janitors were as cool when I was in high school as John Capello's.
Yeah, my janitor was kind of creepy.
Yeah, same here.
I think every janitor was creepy.
Nobody wants to clean toilets. Nobody.
Hey, John, what's your bed?
I already had my bed.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, it's your turn, Steve.
Oh, is it my turn? Okay, I'm going with she's having a baby.
How dare you hate on Kevin Bacon?
I
wait, that movie's terrible.
I don't think it's a terrible movie. That's why it's my bad and not my ugly.
I forgot about it. I completely utterly forgot about it.
It's one of my least favorite movie titles.
Yeah, it is a pretty nondescript title. It is a pretty crappy title.
No, it actually is a pretty descriptive title, but...
plain title. It's a plain... Yeah. You know, it's white bread, vanilla...
It's not even about having a baby, though. It's about, like, a quarter-life crisis.
Yeah.
The baby is just a third part of it, though. That's why I was even misled by the title. I thought it was something else. Like, I was really close to picking this movie as my bad, actually.
Oh, my God, that wasn't Molly Ringwald.
No, it wasn't.
Why did I think it was Molly Ringwald?
You know what it probably is? It came right off of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and people were like, you know, that dramatic reveal at the end, you know, that kind of came out of nowhere. And he was like, well, if she's having a baby, I don't want people to sort of like think it came out of nowhere. I have my title. She's having a baby.
No,
in the first draft, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was John Candy's wife is dead.
He does kind of mess around with you a little bit towards the end. You start to kind of wonder. But then it all ends up okay, which is good. But, you know, it's like, I don't know, it felt like, a personal movie. Rather than him trying to emulate the teenagers thing, rather than go back to Breakfast Club or 16 Candles or any of those, it really felt like his most personal film. It felt like something that, you know, he really kind of had his heart in. And I just, you know, as someone who went through it himself, you know, when I had my first daughter, it was kind of, that whole, well, you know, I've got two kids, I'm 30 years old, I guess it's time to not be smoking pot every weekend and having parties. You know,
bite your tongue.
Steve, that's the gateway drug. It leads to carpentry. Families.
It leads to carpentry.
Wait, pull the bottle over. I want to take a hit.
But no, it's like, I guess I identified with it that way, you know, like Bacon's character kind of realizing that, you know, his life was empty until he had this child to fill the gap, you know, and I related with that. I definitely could, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
I was just shocked to see Alec Baldwin so young that I couldn't concentrate on the rest of the movie.
So young, but not trying to sneak onto a Russian sub.
And it's got John Ashton in it. I love John Ashton.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, John Ashton. He is pretty awesome.
Such a dickhead in Midnight Run. Such a wonderful, wonderful dickhead.
Forever tainted by the Beverly Hills Cop Association.
So have I left anyone out?
I don't think so.
You guys totally lost me after the Michael Wincott moment, so yeah.
did New Jersey do his bed?
Yeah, that was 16 Candles.
He started.
Yeah.
That's right, yes.
Yep.
Yeah, and then I just jumped on the train.
Yep.
Yeah. So your bed was 16 Candles as well?
Yep.
Okay.
On to the ugly. This is, of course, the No Holds Barred. I really hate this effing movie. Let's rail on it some and see if we can make anyone else on the show cry. Andrew, go!
Oh, I am going to say I'm really torn because I want to say Breakfast Club, but I really feel like I have to rip into Weird Science a bit.
Yes, rip into Weird Science for Christ's sake.
Yeah. There were funny parts, but mostly it was just the most disjointed, nonsensical thing. I didn't buy any of the characters. I didn't care about any of the characters.
Robert Downey Jr. deserved every bad thing that's ever happened to him.
Is Weird Science the one where they make the girl?
Yes.
Yeah. Through computer technology.
That's right.
And listen, no matter how attractive you found that girl, she's had sex with Steven Seagal.
She's had three kids. With Steven Seagal.
I just remember a scene where they're sitting at the computer and it's like, no man, make her boobs bigger. That's all I remember.
Yeah.
And what
Gabe and I were talking about it last week. And, what was it, Gabe? Thinking Weird Science was real genius. one of these movies is awesome and the other is like a taint.
Yeah. Even with Vernon Wells, that great thespian. Yep. Bennett.
Why do they have to wear their underwear on their head anyway? That was also in 16 Candles, and I'm like,
because they're nerds.
They're nerds, and they're crazy, and nerds, and computers. Also, Wyatt is a really bad actor. Ian Mitchell Smith. I could have sworn I'd seen him in something else, but I'm pretty sure I haven't seen him in anything else, and he's just, like, I don't know, this haunting presence in my nightmares makes things perpetually bland.
Don't you guys love the opening theme, though?
Yeah, where it talks about Weird Science being weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it sung by John Carpenter and the Coupe de Villes?
And actually, with Danny Elfman.
Really?
Oingo Boingo,
Oingo Boingo.
Wow. Well, all those people who tell me Oingo Boingo is good, I apparently now have to ignore and defriend.
Well, there you go. This song is good for something.
Yeah. Bill Paxton. Problem. Bill Paxton
and
does.
Actually, I have one bit of defense for it. Bill Paxton is awesome in this movie.
Oh, it has the Paxton factor.
Yeah, yes. he's yes. the dick older yeah. brother, and it's Paxton is completely relishing this role.
Well, that
and I can't believe it's the same year as Aliens.
Yeah.
Because in Aliens, he like added on 50 pounds of muscle.
Aliens was the next year, I think. But maybe, I don't know when they were made. Maybe they were made sort of.
Oh, no, yeah, Weird Science was 85. Sorry.
Yeah. But, yeah, somehow they find a way to, like, to screw up the, like, standard military flat top so it almost makes him bald. and then has these little like few Wolverine tufts at the side. It's a terrible, amazing haircut. But yeah, as for the rest of the movie,
I had a big problem with the message. Weird Science almost made it feel like it was trying to say, "Don't be a nerd, be a cool guy." It's a problem with being a nerd.
But be yourself.
What's that?
As long as you're cool and have parties, which you can only have if you're already cool, but be a nerd. Also Ferraris, and if I'm not mistaken, it's awesome to pretend to be a black blues singer when you're a 50-year-old white pasty guy.
The message here is just watch Real Genius instead.
Yeah.
I watched that scene in the bar, and I just thought 400 years, like, or it's all back.
I turned on Weird Science and started it, I think, 10 times on Netflix, and just turn it off within 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I really think he's got an issue with geeks. You know, I really think that Hughes just does not like geeks.
Yeah. And he pretends to. He pretends to, like, say, it's like, oh, it's okay, and actually, you know, you can get the girl, but really...
But no. I hated geeks in high school when I was getting all that poom.
I think he was a geek, but I don't think he was, like, a sci-fi geek. I think he was a literature geek.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think he hung out in the drama room a lot.
This is not related to Weird Science.
At all.
I had the Uncle Buck page open, and I just have to share this. There's a guy in Uncle Buck called Pal, and he's hitting on the girl in the bowling alley, and he's this really skeezy guy, but he's got this great movie face. But his actual name is Dennis Cockrum. Just thought I'd throw that in there.
Dude, I honestly thought that was Zito from Miami Vice. Those aren't cops. They're cab drivers.
DC cab. My bad, or my ugly, I have to go with the only choice that makes 100% sense. I have to go with Curly Sue.
Yeah.
I'm tagging in on this one with you, Joe, man.
Fuck
Jim Belushi.
Punch that girl in the face.
Precocious young girl, con artist father who turns out not to be father, but actually adopted bum.
He has a heart of gold, goddamn.
He has a heart of gold, and he falls in love with the lawyer, and of course the three of them have a family at the end, and everybody learns...
A heart of gold is the only thing in this universe that excuses Jim Belushi going on living when John Belushi died.
Yeah, everything comes together, everybody leaves learning something, Steve vomits. It's not a good scene.
Oh.
It was a bad... I saw it in theater. I saw Curly Sue in theater, and it was horrible.
Hey, Fred Thompson was in it.
I don't care. I don't care if Michael Wincott was in it.
Oh, man, imagine Michael Wincott as Curly Sue.
Oh.
Look out, everyone. The world's most stabbiest con artist is in town.
Now get me a chocolate milk. Before I have you run through. These tights itch. These things stick to your butt. Is this theme song by Ringo Starr? He was the worst Beatle. Slap my butt. No way.
Okay.
Oh, Michael Winston.
Interesting fact about Curly Sue. Curly Sue was the film debut of Steve Carell.
Yes, it's on there.
And he didn't do another movie until 2003.
That's it.
That's how bad Curly Sue was.
What happened to James Belushi?
Was this before or after the Danny Carvey show?
Yes, have some.
Mm.
That's my answer to that one. We're talking about John Hughes movies. I actually can't be bothered to have the IMDb page open.
What happened to Jim Belushi after Curly Sue?
Yeah.
Abraxas, Guardian of the Universe.
Oh!
That's what happened to Jim Belushi after Curly Sue.
Oh.
Okay. Thief and Taking Care of Business were a galaxy away.
Wow. What was the one he was in? I'm pretty sure it was a James Belushi movie where it's the the old movie poster was a painted poster of him, like, leaning over the seats of a Cadillac or something, a convertible Cadillac.
No, there was Taking Care of Business was a Drew Struzan poster, and it was him on Cadillac, like a skateboard.
Okay.
And do you know what I find really odd about Jim Belushi?
That you hate him?
He was in The Ghost Rider, which was like Roman Polanski's second last movie.
Yes.
Like Roman Polanski was like, you know what? I think I need more Jim Belushi in this. And he was actually good at it.
No, Roman.
You know what? Jim Belushi.
And how many canine movies did he do?
He was actually good in
canine? How many canine movies were there? One was too many.
Two more of these. K-9-1-1, K-9-P-I.
What, really?
Yeah.
K-9 P.I. Warshawski, co-starring Kathleen Turner as Max.
And just,
it's really sad, though, because the original
was also
doctor...
in,
what?
He was also in Oliver Stone's Salvador, and he was great in that.
He was great in Salvador, yeah, he was.
Everyone in Salvador was great, though.
My God. He's playing the Cowardly Lion in a Wizard of Oz movie.
Is oh.
Oz Great and Powerful or something?
No, this one's Dorothy of Oz. It's an animated one with Patrick Stewart and Dan Aykroyd and Kelsey Grammer. It looks like a star-studded but low-budget star-studded.
He's also on a TV show called Doc McStopins. And that's all you need to know about Jim Belushi.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, for my ugly...
Go, Gabe, go.
Yeah, I did choose 16 Candles. There's so much wrong with this movie that I don't even know where to begin. It's just a slapdash of different parts that never fit together. The ethnic stereotypes isn't just Song Duck Dun. The sister is marrying is some Italian guy, so of course his parents are in the mob.
but they have to give him a really sleazy name, so he's called Richek.
The whole conflict of the movie is that this annoying girl didn't have her birthday. I just wanted to kill Molly Ringwald at the end of this movie.
This is a sweet 16. That's a big deal to a girl.
Actually, you know what? The premise of it, I don't mind. Like, I would be pissed if people forgot my birthday, but, yeah.
People forget my birthday all the time.
Yeah, but you like it that way.
Not me, Honey Peach. I bought your birthday gift 4 months in advance.
Now we have Facebook to remind us.
Woo!
Don't forget any birthday.
God bless you.
Yeah. Like, I finished watching it, and I was wondering how people could ever like that movie. Seriously, I was like, what the hell were they thinking?
Then he saw me on Facebook saying, I might pick it as my good. And he's like, oh, Steve. Why are you so...
Did you know that at the age of 6, Molly Ringwald released an album entitled I Want to Be Loved by You, Molly Sings? I thought that might make you like her more.
And another strike against it is, like, for the most part, I feel John Hughes really uses music well in his movies. But in this movie, it's just background noise. There's no point to any of the music that's playing in it. And, yeah, it's like if he had, like, 1,000 ideas and just decided to throw them all into this movie. Like, there's no coherent script ever. And yeah, of course, the day trip, it's horrible. Hey, geek, it's all right. You can totally rape my girlfriend because I love Molly Ringwald anyways.
No, it's okay because it's sort of ambiguous.
And just the fact that Jake and the geek bounded together doesn't make sense either. Nothing makes sense.
No. And it doesn't make sense, basically, the thing that initiates Jake Ryan, good solid name there, being interested in Molly Ringwald is that he basically finds out that she would have sex with him. Yeah, but his character's entire character is supposed to be about how he wants something, like, real and deep, right?
True.
and
typical high school guy.
And there's a complete, and also totally gratuitous boob shot in the shower.
Woo!
Wait, that's a. Is that a? Are you saying that's actually bad or?
No, I'm saying it's bad.
Rated PG. I was impressed with that. You have F-bombs in there too? Oh.
Man, the soundtrack to 16 Candles was 18 minutes long.
Huh.
What a ripoff.
Yeah. But it did have Bowie on it.
No, Bowie's not on the actual soundtrack CD.
What?
The entire CD is 16 Candles by Stray Cats, Hang Up the Phone by Annie Golden, Geek Boogie by Ira Newborn, Gloria by Patti Smith, and If You Were Here by the Thompson Twins. Four of the five songs on that CD are less than 3 minutes in length.
Patti Smith did Gloria?
Yeah. She does a great version, too.
Moving on.
It's
next.
Not the Gloria you're thinking of.
Oh, okay. Never mind. Who's next? Yeah. Matt. Yeah. You're ugly.
All right, I was very close.
Matt,
very,
you're ugly.
Sorry. I got that a lot. I was very, very close to choosing Curly Sue for this. I was so close because I watched Curly Sue just dead. My brain just turned off, and I'm sitting there drooling watching Curly Sue with no emotion.
Why did you do that?
I thought I had to research. I don't know. But I had to go with Uncle Buck. Uncle Buck, just the humor. I thought it was just bad jokes. I thought the setup was horrible. It seemed to be the entire reason that people were like, oh no, not Uncle Buck at the beginning, was that he's a bit of a slob, I guess. I mean, they were like, they're talking about him like he's this horrible person. Like, oh no, his girlfriend
sells
tires.
He doesn't want to settle down and have no job and raise no kids.
No. See, they're too uptight, but also he's unemployed.
Yeah, this thing kept going on.
He gambles too and enjoys the blues. What a deviant.
Yeah, it's everything they try to say what a horrible person is. It's kind of like he can get along with Bender, I think, who's also not a very horrible person. And is everything they kept – the whole basis of the movie was that he's a slobber and he's, you know, like
– They are trying to think of someone to look after their kids.
Yeah, but he wasn't that bad. He was overall pretty responsible. And, like, the little funny moments that he was doing, like, the music would kick in. It's like, uh-oh, what's Buck up to now? He's making giant pancakes. Is that funny?
Oh, that zany Buck.
Yeah, he's hanging clothes from the ceiling fan to dry. It's not really funny. It just all the jokes, I just thought they all fell flat for me.
Matt, do you know what a hatchet is?
Yeah. I don't know. Do I have no soul? Is that it? I just don't.
No, I
agree. No, the problem is you have a brain.
In this movie.
The whole thing with the sex crazed neighbor too, that really, that's the part that I hated the most. Like,
yeah,
she just dances like she's striking her crutch against him and stuff.
Against Buck?
I don't make an argument that it's a particularly good movie by any stretch.
Any movie,
but I find it,
any movie wherein John Candy's character hooks up with the attractive woman is inherently terrible. Because it's just so fake.
Well, maybe she had a thing for trolls.
Well, after he doesn't want to get with her, her only line is something like, oh, well, the FedEx man is coming. Anyway, she'll jump on anything.
I'm not sure what
moves, I think.
Honestly,
why didn't he punch her like he punched a clown? It's like, lady, you are a whore.
You are not a nice lady. I think a movie would have been amazing if Michael Wincott played Buck.
That might have made Bug more unlikable. Maybe I wasn't sold on him being such a horrible person either. He seems like kind of a slacker. But for him to be like the villain of the movie, you know?
Yeah.
Wincott. Ever hear of a ritual killing? I mean, genuinely terrifying.
And he wouldn't have drilled the lockout through the door. He would have. You would have seen the power drill in his hand, then he would have kicked the door open and planted it between Bug's eyes.
Yeah.
There would have been murder. All because they trusted Michael Wincott with children.
School.
Just call the school, find out what time, and meet you right here.
Okay, so
we need somebody to take care of the kids. What about Buck? Didn't Buck just get out from serving 30 years at Joliet?
Yeah, he was the warden. He liked whipping the inmates.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so, in summation, thoughts on John Yu's body of work as a whole, Matt?
I think objectively, he's not a really great filmmaker, but again, he got everybody when they were young, and people have a lot of fond memories, and nostalgia is incredibly, incredibly powerful. And there's nothing we can say to someone who saw Weird Science, 200 times when they were 11. And there's nothing we can say to convince someone like that he's not a great filmmaker. My wife, she grew up watching Curly Sue, and she was looking forward to watching that again with me this week. And she loved it again watching it this week. And I said, if you saw that for the first time today, would you like it? And she said, no way. I think he made a real cultural impact. And overall, we got to thank him for that.
How about you, Andrew?
Well, actually, something I was going to talk about and I never really got around to is the fact that I do feel like, sort of like John Landis, John Hughes is one of those few comedy directors that really had a distinctive style. He wasn't like a really adventurous or innovative filmmaker, but he actually did he had a visual style that was recognizable and that worked quite well for the movies he was doing. He did have, I would say, to counter that, he had a habit of kind of making a mess of things and resorting to stereotypes. And we've gone over all that, but for the most part, I think he had a pretty solid career there. And if I were looking back on a career with, those movies that I directed, I'd be pretty pleased with myself, I think. Maybe except for Curly Sue.
How about you, John?
I can't believe nobody from Shermer, Illinois.
What? Hey, what just happened?
You get disconnected, I think.
Said I can't believe nobody brought up Shermer, Illinois.
No?
Oh. I couldn't remember where it was. I just remember that all his movies are always in Illinois.
That seemed like kind of a lost opportunity, too. Like, you could almost make little subtle little connections between all the movies if they really put little hints there or make the Breakfast Club school the same school as the Ferris Bueller school.
If John Hughes had lived,
that could have been cool.
He had George Lucas's money. He'd go back and he'd put, like, Uncle Buck walking by, in 16 Candles, and then... Save Ferris would be on a water tower.
Yeah.
In Weird Science or something.
How about you, Gabriel? Thoughts on John Hughes?
Hey, I'm not finished.
Oh, sorry, John.
I just said I can't believe you bastards. Call me out all the
time. Please, go ahead.
Christ, I'm like the nerd in a John Hughes movie. No, I am. Despite, we've had a lot of fun poking fun at Hughes tonight, but... he was a big part of my childhood. He's a big part of the childhoods of a lot of movie fans our age. And, it's kind of like we said with Landis. I find it absolutely deplorable that the man went out on Curly Sue.
Yeah.
Right? I find it horrible that, after 1991 he never directed again.
I think that was more of his own choice, though.
Yeah, I know, but it's one of those things where you gotta wonder if he had one more left in him.
It's like if John Hughes were to continue directing, that would have been a lot better than Chris Columbus getting a career. Chris Columbus kind of cashed in on John Hughes' career, I think, and ran with it.
Oh man, imagine if John Hughes directed Harry Potter.
Imagine the angst.
Imagine Michael Wincott as Voldemort.
You are the boy who lived.
Imagine him as Hagrid.
I just made that series a million times better.
Imagine John Candy as Hagrid.
Aww.
Imagine Hogwarts in Shermer, Illinois.
How about you, Gabriel? Thoughts on John Hughes?
Well, earlier we talked about his influence on Kevin Smith, and I think that's very apt because he's they're both the kind of directors that very much embody the time and place that they were coming from. But when you go out of the time and place and revisit their movie, they age badly and are maybe overrated. For the most part, I have a hard time, like, feeling much enthusiasm about a lot of Hughes' work outside of Plane and Bueller.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of leaves me cold. I'm just like, meh, whatever.
I think those are probably the only two that are really going to endure.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, his main thing was he was very influential for sure, and I think he brought a certain kind of quirk and interest on the teenagers that maybe wasn't there before youth came in, but other people have done, without even wouldn't have stuff like you know, Clueless or even maybe Dazed and Confused. And I think, yeah, there are people that have focused on these issues and have done better than Hughes has done. But without him, we wouldn't have those better movies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's funny that you kind of mentioned Dazed and Confused, because I did kind of think that, you know, Dazed and Confused, outside of the fact that Linklater lived that experience, could almost have been a Hughes movie. Like, it felt too genuine to be a real Hughes movie, but it could have almost been. You know, it was kind of structured like his earlier stuff.
It was just one Asian stereotype away.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it just needed some date rape and an Asian stereotype.
By the way, was Mickey Rooney busy?
Might be able to consider Ben Affleck the date rapist in Dazed and Confused.
He's more the...
But he's enjoying that way too much, man.
No, it's...
And so you're watching... Gay!
It's... No, I like... What I think Hughes really brought to the table was... I think he had a great gift for dialogue. I think he was... Sometimes he could be a little too hip. And I think that's why his characters didn't always feel genuine, didn't always feel true. But...
Mm-hmm.
He definitely had a gift for funny dialogue and great exchanges, and he casted pretty well, you know, like Judd Nelson in The Breakfast Club, as believable or unbelievable or cliche as that character is, Nelson hit it out of the park.
Mm-hmm.
I won't forget about him.
Yeah, exactly. and you know, Matthew Broderick in Ferris Bueller, of course, that was kind of a star-making thing, and people tend to overlook Cameron, but I thought Cameron was fantastic too, you know. Mm-hmm.
Cameron's the best part of that movie.
Yeah, yeah. And even as annoyed as Gabe was by her, I thought Molly Ringwald was great in 16 Candles, and I enjoyed her in The Breakfast Club immensely.
Oh, I actually like the way she was playing, but it's the character. It's not Ringwald that I wanted to kill. It's her character.
You just...
you should have clarified that, because I already put the contract out.
It's a perfectly natural reaction to a 16-year-old girl, though, wanting to kill her. It's generally unlike her.
I got a question for Andrew. If Ferris Bueller is the manic pixie dream girl of Ferris Bueller,
yeah,
what is Charlie Sheen? Because he's like the dark mirror universe version for Ferris's sister.
And that scene, man, that cameo, that Charlie Sheen cameo.
I think he's like the brilliant. He's like the Obi-Wan. You know, like, look into yourself.
Like, I wonder if that short little cameo is what got him Platoon.
You know?
Maybe.
But yeah, Hughes is a guy, you know, technically, no, he's not a solid director, much like Smith or Linklater. You know, they don't really have great chops in terms of, like...
I disagree.
No?
I'll fight you. Sorry, continue.
Doesn't surprise me. No, like, they're not... technically accomplished directors, you know, they're not guys who sit down and focus on shot compositions and framing and whatnot. You know, they generally tend to point and shoot. They're more concerned with their screenplay. They're more concerned with their dialogue. They're more concerned with, you know, getting their point across, and that's all fine. That's all fine and dandy. And I mean, it's kind of sad that in later years he really kind of slid into that, just that Hollywood garbage, you know, Uncle Buck and Curly Sue. I mean, they were just products of the time, more so than his early movies, which were kind of establishing movies. You know, they kind of established the time. And I think that's kind of why he gave it up. I think that's why he took a step back. I think that's why he stopped directing, is because he knew that he couldn't continue the momentum. He knew that he was drifting away from those.
Fuck it. Films. I'll write a movie about a big dog.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I kind of wish that other filmmakers followed in his example in that regard, you know? Like, I kind of wish Kevin Smith had never made Jersey Girl. Sorry, Matt. And I kind of wish that, like...
I agree with you on that one.
I wish that...
It's for another podcast.
You know? But, yeah, I think, you know, he's a director. He wasn't a mainstream director, but he established a certain level of, you know, mainstream appeal for his own films. Like, he did it his way, but he became mainstream in spite of it, you know?
I think he was trying to diversify himself by trying not to just be the high school guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Try to make some bigger movies. I mean, Curly Sue is as formulaic as you get. That's a movie you could just show to a kid and say, go away, watch this movie. Don't bother me for 2 hours.
Yeah, exactly. Like Babysitter.
Lost the magic. Yeah.
It's Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh, I put the Michael Wincott version on by mistake. And now I have to sit up all night with the kids.
Oh, no.
Sally Field, if you take my children away from me.
I was just about to promise I wasn't going to do the voice anymore.
So do Tony Curtis instead.
How about Michael Wincott as Tony Curtis?
I have read all the classics.
Oh, my. Okay, on that note, thanks, guys, for joining me. Gabriel?
Jeff, have we said who we're doing next week yet?
Andrew, Matt, you guys have been awesome.
We haven't said who we're doing next week.
What about me, dickhead?
I said you and you cut me off, dickhead.
I was in junior high, dickhead.
John, you're fired.
You're fired. I believe next week, unless anything changes the plan, is to do the venerable Mr. Howard Hawks.
Oh, Jesus, that's a world away from John Hughes.
Yep.
And then so. Be sure to join us. You've been great. We've been... They came from the...
Unfortunate.
That's it.
Worst episode ever.
We are out.